This is The End User, episode 142 for Tuesday, July 30th, Hitchhiking Unicorns. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. So, Chris, since I'm a futurist, I knew this was coming, but you may have been a little surprised this past week when Google came out with something completely new.
Yeah, I was definitely surprised. I wasn't expecting that in the slightest.
They've already come out with a couple of new weird things like Google Glass, but this one only costs $35 and is available now. Well, if you got one, it's called the Chromecast, and it is a HDMI dongle for your TV. You plug it in, and then it syncs with Chrome. That's basically it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's there is a lot more to it. There's a lot more potentiality to it. You know, right off the bat, they've got four services that are available to stream to the HDMI dongle, which it's worth noting that the software services is called Chromecast, and the dongle itself is also called Chromecast. So that's a little confusing. I wrote an article for the DMZ about this, and I found myself wondering what to call the dongle versus the services. But anyway, The dongle has some future possibilities, which I think are very, very interesting. And what it can do right now is it can sync up four different cloud services for you, and among which are, what is it, Netflix, it's the Google Music and the Google Movies. They've said that Pandora is coming. And what's cool about this is that it doesn't actually stream over your local network, although you can stream something over your local network in the form of a Chrome tab. So if you've got Chrome open and you're streaming a tab to the TV, then whatever's in that tab you get to play on the TV. But what's a little more interesting is the way Netflix has it integrated. So if you take the Netflix app and you hit the cast button, then it will automatically talk to Netflix from the dongle and queue up whatever you told it to cast. So that makes it a little more interesting because you're not actually streaming over the local network. You're streaming from Netflix's cloud down to the device. And Google has provided an open API for implementing all of this. So any third-party developer can take this API and make a app that has a cast button to send things to the TV. So I think that's really interesting. And Google is locking it down for the moment and not allowing just any old developer in there. But over time, I have to imagine they're going to open up the API and kind of let the platform free. So if they do that, I think they may have a hit on their hands. But of course, it's really hard to say what will and will not be a hit. Maybe you have some advice from the future.
Well, what I really like about this thing is that it's simple. It's unobtrusive. I mean, you could put this on a TV that's already hanging on a wall, and you'd barely even notice that it was there.
Right.
The other thing I like about it is that it's basically platform agnostic. Everything runs through Chrome, but it can run through pretty much any iteration of Chrome, whether you're running Chrome OS or Windows or Mac or Android or iPhone. I guess there's no Chrome for Windows Phone yet, but maybe there's one coming.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that if they open up the platform, you'd expect to see Windows Phone and BlackBerry get in there. But yeah, you know, they've got the most popular platforms right now, and that kind of makes sense to have that be the case initially. Now, Taylor, here's where it really gets interesting with the Chromecast. You know, all of that stuff is interesting, but this is where it really opens up. Not only can you implement an API to make an app that can send content to the dongle, you can actually implement an app that receives content from an arbitrary sender. So you can, and again, this is closed for the moment. They're not going to allow just anyone to do this, but using their receiver API, you can actually make a receiver device. So that gets interesting when you think about people like TiVo, set-top boxes and cable boxes implementing some kind of Chromecast receiver. And obviously that's a big leap to take, But I think that is where they could really open up the platform and have it actually become a standard of sorts.
Oh, I see. So you wouldn't even need the dongle.
Right.
That is interesting.
So you can implement a receiver app in JavaScript. So presumably you could have an instance of Chrome up somewhere on your network, and you could have an app that has the sender API implemented, and you could absolutely send from that app to the receiver that is not the little dongle.
Sure. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So, I mean, I could imagine, you know, I use Windows Media Center for the moment, and I could imagine somebody building some kind of plugin for it somewhere down the road. You know, this kind of stuff isn't possible yet. This is not what they've really announced quite yet. But, man, that is really enticing, just looking forward into the future and looking into the crystal ball and trying to figure out what they're doing.
Sure. I think in the short term, this device is going to be very popular in and of itself, even once they open the API to things like that. The fact that this is only $35 is going to price a lot of those kinds of competitors out of the market for a while.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. So you have a device that adds a lot of functionality to it in a way that this little dongle just cannot. So I think they've got an interesting strategy because they're throwing this $35 dongle out there and probably either making a very slim margin or no margin at all, and getting the platform out there into the hands of users so that they can get some user base. You know, we've seen AirPlay get integrated into some AV receivers. And if Chromecast can do the same thing and get integrated into AV receivers and different kinds of little boxes that connect to your TV, like Roku or something like that, then they've really got a platform that is extensible and can be built upon. Now, that's how you become a standard.
Absolutely. And as a third-party hardware developer, there's no strong reason not to have support for both Chromecast and AirPlay.
Yeah, why not both? So
now,
I've let my imagination run a little bit, but for now, it's a closed API that is open to developers that have written into Google and gotten permission to use it. And for now, it's just this dongle and just Chrome.
All right, well, let's bring it back to the end user now.
Okay.
Let's bring it back to the end user now.
Let's.
The question is, who should get this? And my answer is, if you don't already have an Apple TV or a Roku or a Media Center computer.
Right.
And here's the thing. The Chromecast dongle is USB powered. So you have to power it through an external source unless you're lucky enough to have a powered service USB port already on your TV, and you'll still need the cable. But that's going to make a big difference for people who buy this thing, whether their TV can power it or whether they'll have to power it externally.
Well, there's two thoughts on that. So I could imagine, yeah, it would be really convenient to plug into a USB port on the back of your TV, but I could also imagine a world where you can plug it into the wall behind your TV, like all your other gear, and then if you're TV's power goes out for some reason, then this thing is independently powered. So I could see some...
But it's plugged into your TV.
Yeah, I guess so.
So its entire mode of communication lost power. So it doesn't really do much good to have it powered independently from the TV.
Yeah, I suppose so. I could see some things happening like with that situation. I'm sure there's an edge case there somewhere. But you're right, massively trumped by just plugging it into a USB on the back of your TV.
Right. I think that would be very convenient. I know some of the TVs that I've had do, and some of them don't. But I've got one other reason that you might want to buy the Chromecast dongle. It's an even sillier reason, and that is its product serial number.
What?
Well, Google decided to give a model number on this thing, H2G2-42. Now, if you're a high-level nerd, you know right away that this is the acronym usually given to Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and 42 is a significant number in that book series.
So maybe its abilities are not overblown, you know, all of this talk of unicorns and the like. Maybe it is actually...
Whoa, whoa, Chris. What? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's go back to the unicorns.
Yeah, the article that I wrote for the DMZ is called Chromecast Unicorns in the Cable Industry. And there have been a lot of similarly over-the-top headlines. It's really gotten a lot of attention.
So how are there unicorns?
Because this device... So it all spurred from one line that I wrote in the article.
Which was?
So I said that there had been a lot of over-the-top headlines, and I linked to a couple of them and said, there have also been some realizations that the device is in fact not a unicorn with blood of the cable industry dripping from its alicorn.
Well, that's a shame. I kind of wanted to see that.
No, I think...
Although
it would
be really inconvenient to plug a unicorn into the back of my TV.
Yeah, I don't think there's a port for that. But I think cable companies need to work with this. You know, and maybe I'm giving them too much credit, but I would love to see some of this goodness come into, like, a cable box.
Well, we've seen a few strides of cable companies starting to work piecemeal with Roku and Vudu and Apple TV. Maybe we'll start to see a little bit more of that. It'll certainly take a while if it happens at all.
Oh, yes. Yes. This is a 5 years down the road kind of project we're thinking about.
Right. So that's another good point. Don't buy the Chromecast unless you have a use for it right now. Don't buy and expect for it to get new features later. If you want new features later, just wait for the new features later.
I think at $35 and the fact that anyone using Chrome on a laptop can send a tab to the TV. I think that's almost enough right there with as cheap as this thing is.
That is. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, so they're sold out right now. I'm disappointed. I will not have one anytime soon. And we'll have to, because for $35, I will throw down the cash immediately whenever it becomes available.
Don't lose hope, Chris. You'll get that unicorn.
All right, so Google has announced another very interesting thing. And that is the Google Nexus 7, the new one, the Google Nexus 7 2. They're just calling it the Nexus 7.
Well, didn't they? I think they did a refresh last year as well. But this is a full redesign of the Nexus 7.
Right.
And it's got all new internals, much faster processors. But the main thing is the screen.
Yeah, the screen, by all effects, looks fantastic. So this is a 7.02-inch screen size, and it's 1920 by 1200 pixels. It's an IPS display, and that puts it at 323 pixels per inch, which is above that of the original classification of the iPhone as Retina display.
Well, the iPhone is 326.
Right. But they said, in the keynote, they said anything above 320, that was the magic number. And, of course, that's a lie, but...
well, it was an oversimplification, but either way, this beats it. This is a higher pixel density than even the Retina display iPad.
Right.
And a much greater resolution than any iPhone out there. Of course, there are phones at 5 inches and smaller that have a much higher resolution, depending on how you measure it, but this is the biggest, sharpest thing out there.
Right. Now, I really like this in a way that I haven't been interested in the Nexus 7 before. I mean, the Nexus 7 was a great device, but this really puts it over the top.
This does, yeah. And for only $229.
Nice. And that's the right price for a 7-inch device, right? So what is the iPad Mini by now?
That is $330?
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. That sounds about right, though. But so, rounding out the specs, you've got a 1.5 gigahertz Snapdragon S4 processor. That's a new variant of Snapdragon, as far as I'm aware. And it's got a full 2 gig of RAM, which is kind of impressive. And they have a rather disappointing 5 megapixel camera on the back, which I don't think matters at all for a tablet.
Well, previously there was no camera on the back.
Right, yeah, previously there was none. So, I don't know. I don't think the camera on the back is a big deal. Although, I do, with surprising regularity, watch people take photos with their iPads out in the public.
I used to see it more. I try to actively discourage it.
Do you walk up to people and say, oh, no, don't do that?
I just smack it out of their hands. Why?
Complete strangers, you walk up to them and just slap it out of their hands. I like this.
Yeah, it's a great way to start a conversation.
Or get arrested. Either way.
Well, the original Nexus 7 was a great device. I've heard a lot of rave reviews. It's been wonderful every time I've had my hands on one, and this is way better and not really more expensive. So if you're in the market for a 7-inch tablet, this is the one to get right now above the iPad Mini. But when the iPad Mini with Retina display comes out, ooh boy.
Well, then you'll be really excited. So we should mention that the new Nexus 7, then we'll move on after this. The new Nexus 7 will arrive on July 30th. So as of us recording this right now, that is tomorrow. And for the people in the chat room, by the time you listen to this, or for the people not listening live in the chat room, which is most of you, then you'll it'll already be in the market. So
yeah, actually, some people have already received theirs. It's happened already. They said July 30th, but they're out there in the wild already.
But they slipped it.
They did. Now, there's one more thing to mention, though, Chris, and that is the Nexus 7 is running a brand new version of Android, 4.3 Jelly Bean, which we didn't really know anything about until last week. So now we're going to talk about what everyone else will eventually get with 4.3 Jelly Bean Android.
There's actually not a whole lot of stuff here. They've been iterating over Android so much, and I feel like this is just kind of the next iteration.
Right, so let's run down a few of these
quickly.
So they have user account control that includes restricted profiles. So I'd imagine this will be great for families who get a Nexus 7 and, you know, they want kids to use the tablet but not mess around with it.
Right, so that's pretty cool, and that's something I was always upset by with, you know, when the iPad came out. I thought, well, how nice would it be to have separate user accounts like you do on Windows or OS X and kind of cordon off your life on that device from other people's life on that device? And this at least goes partway to solving that problem.
Right. Another feature that I think is really cool is it has a mode that will allow you to use Wi-Fi only for assistive GPS. So it saves power by not having Wi-Fi in full data transmitting and network scanning mode, but can still identify networks that help it give a more accurate GPS coordination.
Right. So
I'm always annoyed by this. Whenever I try to turn Wi-Fi off on my iPhone to save battery, it tells me that my GPS will suffer. And in my experience, it does.
Yeah, so AGPS is where they can grab onto a few known Wi-Fi hotspots and triangulate your position approximately within something like 20 yards or something like that.
Well, it depends on how good the GPS signal is and how many Wi-Fi signals they get.
Right, right. So that's kind of cool. I remember back in the old days with this was a Windows Mobile 6 device. I was able to get GPS without having GPS because it had AGPS. So I could just flip the Wi-Fi on, and magically it would locate me.
Right. So it's pretty sweet. It's definitely better to have Wi-Fi and GPS.
Right.
But Wi-Fi and GPS are both separate antennas that use a lot of power. So if you can get the best of both worlds with that, that's even better. I think that's pretty great. And finally, there is low-power Bluetooth pairing. And nice. Dial pad autocomplete. This is a big deal to you, but I don't understand its relevance.
So assuming this works how I think it works, you get a dial pad and you can dial somebody's name in the T9 letters and it will kind of fuzzy autocomplete for you so that you get a list of people who match whatever T9 you typed in.
Oh, okay.
So
that's kind of cool.
That's really powerful, by the way. I had this a long time ago on Windows Mobile 6. Once again, I'm throwing you back. But yeah, you could get to just about anyone in your contact book with two or three clicks, and you were good to go.
Chris, I haven't used T9 since like 2005. Well, I mean, why? why do we need to bring this back?
No, it's just downright efficient, and I feel that is the most. That is the best way that you can dial somebody in your contact list, far and away. And I know this is a little feature and I'm making a big deal out of it, but I'm really glad to see that this hasn't gone completely by the wayside because nobody else had it. You know, after I gave up a phone that had that feature on it, no one else did that. So I'm glad to see it make a comeback.
Okay, great. one more feature that I wanted to mention. This was going to be our first kicker, but why not? They've also announced Play Games is sort of like iOS's gaming center app that lets you just have a centralized location for social games and connecting with your friends. In iOS, I like this feature not because of the actual like social networking that it lets you do, but just the fact that it connects to your account automatically and can show you within the games themselves, you know, who's playing what, which Android already does a pretty good job of. Any game that I play on my iPhone that is also an Android game, I can usually see my Android-wielding friends and their scores in that game as well.
Yeah, so this, for me at least, reminds me of the Xbox Live, I forget what they call it now, but the Windows Phone Game Center. It strikes a pretty good resemblance.
Yes, excellent. All right, with that, should we turn on our afterburners?
Yes, let's do. Why don't you get us started?
All right. Verizon last week launched three new phones in its Droid platform. They are pretty impressive new phones, although they're using a lot of marketing speak. One is the Droid Ultra, which they're claiming is an 8-core phone, but that's a bit of a marketing speak. One of those supposed 8 cores is dedicated purely to contextual search. So it's basically just crunching the words and syntax that you're using to try to make more sense out of search. Then they have launched the obligatory mini version of their gigantic Android phones, which is, again, no surprise to you and me, a 4.3-inch display. And then they will have the Droid Max, which is the same 5-inch Droid Ultra, but with a gigantic battery that supposedly affords 48 hours of heavy use.
And we've gotten a look at the Leap Motion controller. You remember this. I'm sure we've talked about this on previous The End Users. There have been some reviews that have been posted, and this is an $80 device that sits in front of your laptop or computer, and you can wave your hands in the air, kind of similar to a Kinect to control things on the screen. And it looks like it's a good idea in search of better software, it seems to be the consensus I've seen around, in that, you know, it's not quite precise enough for some things, and you really have to write custom software for it, but it's kind of a good initial out-the-gate start for this kind of technology. So I'm looking forward to see what kind of improvements they can muster, and it looks to be a decent device out of the gate, at least, for early adopters.
Yeah, it's hard to launch something like this when you don't have vendor support built in. They had to launch their own marketplace, and it's very early days in this. It's basically just for beta testers and developers, and so the software is not there yet. But what we would love to see someday is to have Leap Motion control built in at the OS level, and maybe even having these Leap Motion controllers built in the computers themselves.
Yeah, I would love that. That would be a great idea. Just build it right into the palm rest of a laptop. That would be kind of cool.
Totally.
All right, so we've got some Xbox news as well. They are confirming that indie developers will be able to push games out to the Xbox One. So you remember that Xbox One that was online only and would ping home every once in a while that couldn't have indie games on it?
That one that didn't exist?
Right, yeah. All of that's pretty much gone. So I have to imagine that the general public will kind of forget about the little missteps that they've had, and most people aren't even going to realize that that was what they wanted to do in the first place. But I think this is the right move, and I think it's a good thing for them to move forward with their new platform when that happens.
Okay, cool. I think they also announced some details about their controllers. I think they're going to be $60 wireless controllers.
Yeah, and they take AA batteries.
Do they really?
Yes.
That's disappointing. Now, in our last Afterburner story this week, Verizon is launching a new top speed of their Fios service. They used to offer 300 megabits per second, but now in competition with Google's fiber, which is 1,000 megabits per second, they are launching a new tier at 500 megabits per second for $310 per month.
Jeez.
Plus taxes, fees, and extra service add-ons.
All right. So that's for businesses, not for consumers, right?
Oh, that's totally for consumers. Wow. And if you want the fastest internet possible and you don't live in one of three cities that has gigabit internet, I'm sorry, there are more than three cities, but it's not that many. There are more potential Fios customers than gigabit fiber customers in the U.S. And for them, if you want the fastest, you got to go with Verizon.
Yeah, or you could just move into a country that has faster bandwidth, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't mind moving to Korea.
Yeah, or go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be pretty
good. Well, that's probably more expensive.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. All right, well, let's get out of the weeds, and let's turn off the afterburners. You can unclick your seatbelt. I'm assuming you had it on for your own safety in the first place, right?
Of course I did. I'm just going to leave it on just in case.
Okay, yeah, just in case. Why not? And we'll move into the end user stories. I came across an interesting article, and this is the specifics of the article maybe aren't that interesting, but it's talking about home automation systems and their surface area for attack. So, I mean, you put in all of these connected devices into your house, and you can automate every light in your house through the magic of the internet, but that increases your surface area so that hackers can potentially break into your house and start to affect things. So this actually has happened in real life to a real human. You know, it's not some tinfoil hat kind of thing. Of course, it's still very, very unlikely. And the device that was under attack here were some Insteon controllers that, by default, don't have a username and password on them. And you can add that username and password and be protected. But by default, they did not have that. So somebody was able to break into somebody's virtual house, as it were, and affect physical things. So I think that's kind of a new spin on security, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, to me, this is just one of the next fronts of security through obscurity, right? These people are expecting that the technology is limited enough and customized enough that no one is going to be targeting it for hacking. But security through obscurity can never last very long. It is not a futurist's security of choice.
Right. So I have to imagine, you know, there's this curve that we see over and over and over again. You see it in the internet. You see it in startup companies. You see that when we first get some toys, like the internet itself, the web, you know, there was no security. There was none. That was a complete afterthought. We had a bunch of systems that are just sitting out there on the net, and you know, they could be hacked into quite easily. But people would say, "Well, why would anyone do that? Why would you hack my box?" And you know, eventually we ditch that kind of naivety and we get real security up and running. And I feel like home automation is in the early days in a way that a lot of the rest of the technology industry is not. So I think we're going to see this curve happen where we've got some kind of weak security happening here up front, and then eventually over time they'll harden themselves. So I'm glad to see that this is being raised as something for people to think about, but ultimately I don't think it'll affect that many people for the moment.
Yeah, definitely not for the moment. This is something that will come up much farther down the road.
Now, wouldn't it be kind of crazy that, you know, all of a sudden your light just flickers on and off, perhaps in a Morse code or something?
Oh, well, I'm haunted, so that happens to me all the time. No, not really.
All right, well, let's stick with the security theme and move into some malware news. What do we got here?
All right, so this is the first known malware in the wild that targets OS X and Windows equal opportunity. So it'll target either one. What this is a piece of malware that uses a YouTube page to exploit a flash vulnerability to direct machines to secret servers that then conceal themselves and replicate. But the main thing is it is a YouTube video that can load malware onto a Mac or a PC.
Interesting. So I don't think the article says, but do we know what the kind of attack vector was? You know, like what language it was or something like that?
No, I don't have that information, and I probably couldn't explain it if I did.
Yeah. So
it uses a special Unicode character known as a right-to-left override.
Okay. There you go. So beware of that. There's always, you know, the next little thing of security out there, and when you click on links, you have to be careful, especially if they're coming from unsolicited places. So, yeah, just be careful out there.
Right. So that is our end user, the end user public service announcement.
That's right. That is our PSA. So, we've got a green tech story of the week. What do you got?
We do. This one I've been holding on to for a few weeks. It helps you compare the cost of driving an electric vehicle versus a gasoline vehicle. This is a U.S. Department of Energy calculator online that uses their very precise and specific methodology to help compare the cost of each in a variety of metrics. So if you were thinking about getting a range-assisted electric vehicle or a hybrid electric vehicle or an electric vehicle or not an electric vehicle, this will help you get a better idea of what those costs associated with will be, especially when it comes to driving, which is a very small cost when an electric car, but it adds up in the long run.
So this is the miles per gallon equivalency, right?
Yeah, there are a number of different ways to calculate miles per gallon equivalency, and the Department of Energy has gone through a number of different methods, each one more refined and complicated than the last, and this is one of their latest methodologies called e-gallon, and it shows how the figure is calculated, and then we'll do all the calculations for you.
Right. Now, I've looked into some of the math involved in that, and it's actually quite complicated to do this.
Yes. I mean, they've been working on these calculators for a very long time.
Because, yeah, I mean, ultimately, there is no equivalency, and you kind of have to figure out what kind of things you want to take into account and how to weight them. So. Yeah,
right. Well, there is absolutely a cost equivalency. The problem with electric vehicles is that the batteries are so expensive right now that you pay a lot more of that cost up front.
Right.
So it helps to have a very precise calculator like this that will help you determine how much you can save in the long run, given that upfront cost. But the other thing about it is you want to know how much electricity you're using, because then you can start to do the even more complicated calculations of how many pounds of carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions you are creating or not creating based on your choice of vehicle.
Cool. So if you are one of the few who has an electric vehicle, you'll probably want to have a look at this, or if you're thinking about it. So let's get into our tip of the week, and it's actually kind of a special tip of the week. It's the anti-tip of the week. Because I came across this article this morning on Slate.com, and the article is Down with Life Hacking! And that's a very dramatic headline, but what they're basically saying is that by collecting all of these different kinds of technologies that may or may not give you a small advantage, that you're actually hindering your productivity because you've gotten this very complicated workflow going. So in the end, by cobbling together all of these little so-called life hacks, that you're actually doing yourself a disservice. So I think the idea is kind of keep it simple with long-lasting solutions.
I think it's a very good point, Chris. But as someone who has been life hacking and reading Life Hacker for over 10 years now, I would like to point out that life hackers have already addressed the problem of over life hacking.
Yeah, and I've seen this kind of article before. In fact, probably on Life Hacker. But yeah, just a word, you know, don't get carried away with some of the madness that is life hacking.
Yeah, and it's true. And at this point, you know, you can't even follow all of the advice that any single life hacking blog or guru purports. You have to pick and choose and find out what works for you. You can't life hack everything.
Right. Yeah. You have to figure out where your actual weakness is and apply some critical thinking in that direction, as opposed to just taking everything and trying to be some incredible life hacker kind of person. So anyway, I thought that that was an interesting and kind of measured take on how to not get ridiculous with stuff from Lifehacker.
And I thought it was great that it wasn't my job to find a tip of the week this week.
Yes, for once, I tracked one down for once. And oddly enough, it was the anti-tip of the week. So
right. Well, thank you. Still worth mentioning.
Yeah. So in fact, if we were to count tips of the week, I think I would get minus one for this.
No, you get plus two and then minus one.
Okay, plus two, minus one. That's fair. That's fair. I can live with that.
All right.
All right, well, moving on into our app pick of the week. Not surprisingly, from how we talked about Chromecast at the beginning of the show, that is the Google Cast Chrome extension. So this is the extension that you use to take a Chrome tab and send it to a Chromecast device, or, in the future, a device that implements the Chromecast receiver API. So if you're on a laptop or in Windows or OS X, this is how you would do that. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the extension for those of you who managed to get a Chromecast dongle.
Yeah. Now, it's probably worth downloading the Chrome extension, even if you don't have the dongle, for your laptop in case you take it somewhere where there is a Chromecast, because all you have to do is be on the same Wi-Fi network and it will work automatically.
Also, I'll give you a little bonus tip of the week that I did not put in the show notes, but if you take the file path to a file and paste it into Chrome's address bar, it will begin to play that file, that local file of yours, say an MP4 video, and you can actually stream that local file to a Chromecast device.
Oh, cool. That is cool. I didn't know that.
Kind of a backdoor into getting local files working with the Chromecast dongle. Kind of neat.
Yeah. And here is the hack of the week. If someone is already playing a YouTube video or a file or something off of their Chromecast and you are on that Wi-Fi network and you have your Chromecast extension, you can just play something right over them. It'll just automatically override and play your thing instead of their thing.
Yeah, and while you're at it, you can get at their home automation systems and turn the lights off or something.
Right. Well, that's the next thing.
Yeah, no, I'm really just kidding about that, but they've got some things to work out.
Well, AirPlay was the same way until a rather recent update, and now they've just gone completely the opposite way. Once someone is using AirPlay, you can't override it until they stop.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. Of course, I guess you have to be authenticated against the Wi-Fi anyway, right?
Yeah, either way, for all of these devices, you have to be on the Wi-Fi.
All right, well, let's get into our kicker. What do we have? This is stunning.
Okay. The kicker this week is another picture from space. We've had a few of these recently, especially from the Mars Curiosity rover, which is getting all the big headlines recently. It is coming up on its one-year anniversary of landing from fantastical sky crane descent onto the surface of Mars. But this picture this week comes from the Cassini spacecraft, which is orbiting Saturn right now and taking lots and lots of photographs. It captured an astounding one last week that has Earth far off in the distance, 900 million miles away, glowing bright blue against the backdrop, or foreground, I suppose, of Saturn and its rings and moons.
Yeah, and it's really, really fantastic. It's hard to believe that this is actually happening.
Yeah, that it was an actual device that we launched to Saturn that then turned back towards us and took this picture.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And to get the full effect, you have to kind of look at the entire photo. You know, they've got some zoomed-in version where you can see the moon and the Earth together as two little spheres of light. But to get the full smallness of the Earth from very far away from the vista of Saturn, you really have to view the photo that has the fully zoomed out version of this photo.
Yeah, preferably on a giant 4K TV.
Yeah. How about that? That would be great. So, just kind of breathtaking to me.
absolutely fantastic.
So we've got a link in the show notes to the CNET article that contains some of those photos. And you really must go have a click and take a look at those. They're absolutely stunning. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Taylor, if somebody were to contact you, perhaps from the rings of Saturn, how would they go about doing so?
The best way that I've found so far is to use a complicated, expensive machine of alien origin that will eventually alter the events of space and time so as to provide a message that will get itself to me through unknown means.
So I'm not sure that they have installed a Stargate on Saturn yet.
Oh, well, I was talking about the Kurt Vonnegut novel, Sirens of Titan.
Ah, okay. Okay, well...
But how do you know that they haven't installed a Stargate on Saturn?
I guess I don't know. I haven't sat in front of a Stargate here on Earth to dial the Stargate on Saturn. So
right.
I guess I don't know.
Well, there you go. But I suppose if you didn't want to send me a Vine or a smoke signal or use... a very powerful machine of unknown alien origin. You could probably try me on Twitter, and you would just have to start the tweet at TaylorPhone, TaylorPhone.
Cool, and if you'd like to get at me and give me some feedback about the show or something like that, you can get at me at Chris Hale Barnes on Twitter. So we're out there. Let us know what's going on. Let us know what you think of the show.
Oh, Chris Hale Barnes.
Yes, H-A-L-E. Like,
what's Cry Shale?
So thank you everyone for listening to the show, and of course you can find more information including the show notes with the Saturn pictures at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a handful of other podcasts. Have a look at Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and the newest podcast on the network is Home On. Richard's got a podcast up there with Mike Fauché, the PC doc. You can send us some feedback if you'd like. We are TheEndUser at thedigitalmediazone.com, or by following us on Twitter, we are at TheEndUser. Join us in the chat as we record the show live every Monday night around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
I am Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.